I remember when I used to write email copy, I would just think of my mother reading something. Not that that was my audience, but just thinking of the lens that's outside of the bubble we all live in and getting into the mindsets of people that will decide.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Thomas Gensimer has been working at the intersection of business, technology, and politics for over a decade and a half. Thomas got his start in politics with the Wesley Clark for President campaign in 2003, then helped found and run the important Democratic political technology firm Blue State Digital. Thomas led the marketing and sale of that company to the giant enterprise WPP and managed it for 2 years there, then moved to serve as chief strategy officer at Burston Marsteller, another WPP company. And he's been busy ever since, including working with Blue Labs, the Democratic analytics firm. Thomas knows a lot about scaling a political technology firm, and we had a good conversation about his path thus far, including how he's thinking about scaling his family. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Thomas Gensimer, political technology entrepreneur.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots' library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
How are you today?
Good to see you. I'm good, thanks.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'll try to make it very quick. Born and raised in Western Pennsylvania, rural, now what we call Trump country. Went to NYU, started a business here with a group of guys during the 2004 presidential cycle that people who listen to you will know is Blue State Digital. I was sort of the first client not named Howard Dean when we were all working in the what seems like yesterday in some ways and also is nearly 20 years ago. I had gone through a mix of social and professional circumstances, came to D.C. during the time that digital and politics were just starting to collide. Found myself in 2003 living in Arkansas for Wes Clark's campaign, if you remember, to just zero in on that era. It was Howard Dean versus the world in some ways. And so Blue State was started. I joined after that election cycle and ran the business for the 9 years that followed. Staying in D.C. and politics for the first several years and then tied with when we were working with the then upstart Obama campaign, started focusing on diversifying the business to become more both global, started in London, sort of on the West Coast here, and then doing more commercial work. And then sold the business along with my partners in 2012.
That's a pretty good resume in democratic political technology.
The chapters of which are really fascinating. We've talked a little bit about this in the past, but just the when you think of the rapid cycles of innovation that culture has had to deal with and then break them into four-year chapters and how they've been deployed in politics. Ours was doing the blogs plus mimicking direct mail on email, right? It became sort of the scalable email list. And it's funny to see now, 16 years later, the campaigns begging for $1 contributions via email to qualify for debates. It just is a moment of either deja vu or wow that got us to where we are now.
I was under the impression that there were these four guys from the Dean campaign that started Blue State Digital
right.
And Did you come along right at the beginning with them?
I came along.
Or did you come
like
or they hire you as a professional?
I would say month six probably for the business, or maybe month eight, because I was working for America Coming Together at the time. So after Clark, a group of us came from ACT, and that was my first time sort of properly living in D.C. We worked a bit with Blue State on the side, and I got to know them, and then swapped even some employees. And then I joined in the spring after the 2004 loss.
What were they looking for when they hired you?
I think a mix of portfolio that I had developed in D.C. with ACT and the labor unions and some foundations, and then just commonality of experience.
Yeah.
And then I had come with a bit of early day venture capital experience through a family I used to work for, and so probably had a different set of experiences, either call that commercial, call that whatever, that helped early on.
What was the family you used to work for?
Long story. It's not relevant. Not relevant. I mean, very, very relevant personally and close to me, but not necessary for the for the story. An old political family turned sort of Los Angeles. Been in my life for
what,
a long time.
What attracted you to the West Clark campaign?
This family, actually. We were early investors in Meetup, which got me involved in the 2004 cycle initially.
I know that Dean was using that.
Using it, and then sort of everyone started using it. But so that was my early way into Howard Dean, West Coast fundraising, a little bit of gay fundraising, Hollywood set, and then some with Clinton ties rallied back to Little Rock and did the Clark campaign.
Yeah.
From a donor perspective and from a political endorsements perspective, there was a split. Remember, Clark got in late.
Yeah.
So it
seemed like a really compelling candidate to me.
Totally.
It made some missteps.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But came right out of the military into running a campaign.
That's
so
tough.
It's a difficult thing. There were a lot of early Clinton ties to the Clark campaign beyond geography. And so that was, I did a bit of Dean and a bit of Clark in that, then came to Washington, met these guys along the way, and then became business partners with at least three of us exited the business together. Others over the course of that sort of 8 or 9 years, all still in my life, all, you know.
Well, tell me about the early days of Blue State Digital. That's a firm that has been the technology for a bunch of Democratic presidential campaigns on the emailing and other fronts, and has had a pretty interesting run in Democratic politics. What was it like at the founding or when you came in?
It's too easy to say just sort of scrappy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was about getting the next client contract plus maintaining some political ties. You remember Howard Dean came into the DNC, and so there was a continuity of some of the politics. And then we pretty quickly, you know, Teddy Kennedy was a very early client. We had a really interesting moment.
Everyone wanted whatever magic Dean
and there was
had.
A handful of people that came out of, just like with the Obama years, there was a group of people. There's so many businesses now that have ties to it. I think we managed to have the right timing and then pivoted early enough by way of diversification of the revenue to sustain longer than some of the others have or did.
Tell me about the other partners in that founding.
In some ways we were all so young that it was brothers plus always like alpha male competition between all of us.
Was it?
In a usually good, healthy way that was complementary.
Yeah.
And as I said, like there was four plus one, it ended up being three. But, you know, I think the politics of all of it and the friendliness of all of it was real and sustained mostly to today.
What are the different skill sets that the five of you brought to it?
Some more on the line of creative or copywriting or the sort of call it front end.
Is that sort of the Joe Rosebars?
Joe and myself a little bit. And then you could say Ben and Yasha were more on the technical side.
Yeah.
Be that proper sort of database management and or broader systems.
Yeah.
Very early on we had Clay, who's still around and like sort of a sales thought leadership kind of
sales, maybe.
Yeah, technical and sort of anything, you know. I mean, it could be real estate. It could be, you know, sales is sales.
Yeah.
In many ways, especially in that time.
You were building technology and selling services also, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is, I think we knew it all along, but it's a dangerous mix. It's a hard thing to pull off because the economics are potentially very different, both on the cost side and the potential exit. But because of how the business began, the origin story sort of necessitated those things being somewhat side by side. The innovations, you know, Joe continues it today, what we hear from and see from the Warren campaign. But that embedded nature, it's hard just to say all tech to a certain vendor, all strategy to another, because where are those lines? Where were those lines then? It's even harder to define those lines now. You know, if I think of all of our shared experiences in early campaigns and even early, not campaign, but organization, you know, trade union, foundation, et cetera, was sort of like, oh, the email writer people are here. And if my BlackBerry doesn't work, then they're also in the IT. And I mean, it was a very unprofessionalized client set by way of what they were doing in this space.
Yeah. It was a new thing being developed.
Very much. And I think the earliest successes, as I mentioned earlier, were replications of direct mail. And direct mail was, it still is a very disciplined business. There are players in this town. It's more complicated now, obviously, but clients were looking for the vendor that could sort of do it all and hopefully not get in the way.
And your role was CEO, managing partner, right?
Yeah.
What were the challenges for that?
It's always people business. And yeah, even if you are looking in whatever sector it is, particularly in the mix of people that are working for a cause or working tangentially for a cause and managing a culture around that, I think that's probably the biggest, you would say that's the challenge of today in that business or otherwise. Keeping, maintaining, and growing talent, as well as what I would call sort of organizational fortitude, like enough systems and enough back-end office management, the nuts and bolts of a business. When you grow so organically, both the portfolio and then the structure, you can sometimes have rude awakenings along the way. I think we did a pretty good job of staying buttoned up. I think we always prided ourselves from growing from, you know, I think there was probably 4 or 5 employees when I officially joined, went from sort of being a client and friend to running. We went from 5 to 150 or something.
So, did you raise money or was it all built off of the revenue? It's my preference
totally.
Oh my God. Building a company. Yeah. That's what I did on the NGP side.
Yeah, right. And I think we will get back to a generation of entrepreneurs who recognize that. It's funny, we're sitting in WeWorks. So WeWork, I guess, or just we, and talk about not focusing on revenue and having the capital markets just endlessly available. Not that we would have been anything like that. It's just an ironic kind of.
Why do you agree with me on that? Why do you think it's preferable, if possible, to not raise money and build a company off of revenue?
Well, I think it depends on what company you're building. At times, could have we raised money for the technology side of it and competed more with you at the time or with any number of others? You were in a category adjacent to ours, swimming in the same revenue pool. There were others who were, you know, just doing tech. And I don't know that we ever, maybe the value of a partnership in some ways is that we could never sit in a room like this and articulate what we would do with the money that's worth the dilution. As opposed to, we had a bit of a, at times, spaghetti code reality of some bespoke custom development projects for certain clients that then could be genericized into the code base.
Productized.
And contractually, you know, being upfront about that, you're building a, you know, maybe there's a year that only you, whatever, but maintaining IP through revenue creating work. And that would, most engineers and product teams would absolutely hate that, right? That's a chaotic product development roadmap, no question about it. But
it's paid for.
It's paid for, and it helped balance the needs of, you know, sometimes you needed a certain, forgive the sort of, a certain sign up page functionality that seemed simple, but for whatever reason, other times you needed to send a million emails an hour to get fundraising underway, right?
Which turns out to be harder than one would guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And so managing the clientele that ranged from those two extremes was definitely chaotic, but we owned the business. We preserved the business.
Yeah.
And then we found a buyer. all of that was an interesting journey too, but made more clear and linear by not having outside investors that you needed to please.
And that's a bunch of years of your life that you mm-hmm. spent doing that
sure.
and came to a good conclusion. When you think about the highlights along that stretch, what comes to mind?
I think there's some sort of warm and fuzzy things that were early, you know, year two, year three, like on a good trajectory, realizing that you have, say it's 40 people working and you have, you know, like there's moments of, I can remember holiday parties or victory parties or whatever that was the first experience of feeling like you're running something real. Uh-huh. And then I think while never seamless, the acquisition process, the sort of courting of and marketing of the agency was probably I learned the most.
Did you do that in sort of trying to set up an auction type thing?
I mean, you create a market. Yeah. I mean, we had a professional advisor. We had it. Yeah. We had a process and we tested it along the way and had a pretty clear understanding to manage the expectations of everyone. So it was a year. It wasn't a quick snap thing that suddenly Sir Martin called.
When I ask you about the highlights, your view on that is a very business-oriented view. This is
not the first one. I think it was. I have the sort of soulful one of remembering the moment of pride that was about, you know.
But what's interesting about that firm also is that it was in the middle of big time American politics, right?
Sure.
You had
sure.
people posted out to the Obama campaign sure. in both 8 and 12, your partners. Mm-hmm. You had an involvement, as you said, in senators like Kennedy and others. You're participating in that world. Was that important to you or was that more important to other people?
I think it was important to all of us in different ways. Mm-hmm. I've never been too much of a Kool-Aid drinker mm-hmm. Politically. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in politics for sure.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was a Republican politician, small, like county commissioner, but like I was raised in the era of that. I think by the time I got formally involved in a campaign, I was reasonably attuned to it's about the fundraising, it's about getting the candidate on the call time, it's about doing the, you know, the nuts and bolts of it mm-hmm. that gave you a different perspective. So or a different taste of the Kool-Aid. It was spiked all of a sudden. Yeah. And so I appreciated it and I appreciated the passion of others and how it helped build a culture
yeah.
and attract employees and sort of all of that.
Yeah.
I think I was always, either because I was forced to be or
your role
naturally
was
gravitated,
to run that business.
Was to run and scale the business.
Yeah. What was most difficult about scaling that business?
Again, the talent. It's
just
about
people.
Managing. Yeah, managing the comings and going. We had, and they continue to have sort of strong, loyal people. And even the alums, while a lot ended up in the same space and would be considered in some ways competitors. I think it's a very friendly set of, maybe I'm naive to it because I've been out of it for a while, but I find the reception I get in the however many alums groups. And when I officially left the business, I was invited to a Facebook group that is Blue State alums. Mm-hmm. And I have never joined Facebook, so I couldn't join it, but someone sort of printed out there was at the time 630 people or something in this group. I've always felt a very positive energy from that. A lot of people learned a lot of things and built their careers off of it.
How would you characterize the culture at Blue State Digital while you were there?
Pretty aligned around the business goals and still aware of the strong piece of politics that went in it. Part of going through the transition from being privately held into being part of WPP necessitated a conversation around the business of the business in ways that probably we wouldn't have needed as much of. But it was just also managing 5 offices and 150 people. There was a certain level of this cost structure is high and we have to balance the clients in a way that made sure that there was, you know, growth in the business.
Why did you guys decide to sell it?
It was just a mix of sort of stages in life and opportunity.
Yeah.
I think now I feel, and I don't know directly how the others feel, but I feel lucky to have gotten the market. I think it's a little
you
harder
think you had good
now.
Timing?
I think I had good timing. Yeah. Could have been, you know, plus a year or two, like who can say.
Yeah.
I still track that market and particularly the DC-oriented markets in a certain range of revenue and see where people are thinking about the value of their businesses. So I think that was, you know, that perspective that's sort of when I say how I, what I appreciated most about my time was probably that phase of learning for someone who didn't go to business school, right? Both the hard business of it and just the people side of that business. It was a crash course.
Yeah, it sounds like it. There's a lot of people I've interviewed on this podcast who have considerably smaller political technology businesses, startups in the space. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could explain a little bit for their benefit. Talk us through that process of taking it on the market. What are the steps that you took to advertise that it's available or find the right advisor or negotiate the best arrangement? How did that come about?
I think the first tip or lesson or sort of memory that I spent a lot of time just meeting and having as many conversations as possible mm-hmm. with people a generation older than I was that could have gone through. And I don't even say words, but there have been so many businesses in the 90s and into the aughts that had sold with similar portfolios here in our backyard in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Any in particular that
They've all been a lot. So I'm not going to incriminate anyone who may have been closer advisors than others. Uh-huh. You can even just look at the people who have sold businesses to WPP. Okay. And if you get to that specific, there's 20 in this town.
Okay.
So they're not hard and they don't hide.
Yeah.
And they're typically...
And was WPP something that you focused on early as the most likely?
I don't know early. I was quite familiar with it. I had already set up our London operation, which was a bit of happenstance that I wouldn't necessarily invite on someone to rush to go international. Good for storytelling. I was in a relationship in London, so if I'm going to be there, I might as well.
Make business happen.
And so that's a WPP town, really.
Well, say a word or two about what is WPP.
Oh,
I don't think everyone knows that.
Also an interesting time and a different time for that business. WPP is still the world's largest advertising holding company. So they're alongside Omnicom and Publicis and IPG and, you know, a handful of others that are big old legacy ad agencies and a constant... or previously sort of constant appetite for acquisitions.
They own zillions of companies.
They own hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies.
Right.
They own probably, you know, 20 companies in this town or little brands that are part of companies that people would know of, as do the other holding companies, right? There was a generation that everyone from lobbyists to public affairs to you know, government marketing shops got bought into to consolidate revenue across the globe.
Was it a good purchase for WPP?
The evaluation for how they do that today is different at the time. Mm-hmm. We were certainly not on the high end of acquisitions, right? When they're looking at they're buying giant businesses at times. We were 150 people, 160 people.
Yeah.
The talent that it put into the network that ended up going to other places in the network mm-hmm. and stayed was there. They've, you know, made money on the acquisition if you look at now the years that it's been.
Yeah.
So they've, on the good and bad, did it radically change and improve WPP? No, big ask, right?
Yeah.
Big ask for a small.
Yeah. It's a small percentage
certainly
of their workforce.
It was good for reputation. They got the sort of political hat trick. You know, the next year they bought Joel Benison's shop, to mention just one who's still in the WPP family that everyone knows. They owned in the past from Quinn and Gillespie to some of the old lobbyists, to the Republican lobbyists that we're seeing being involved in Donald Trump. I will not mention names, but, you know, sold
and
businesses to WPP.
And they're not a partisan shop in any way,
of course. They will buy on all sides.
Right.
They will buy on all sides.
And did you have any worries that they would interfere with the...
No, because you sort of negotiate with a lot of it. They have financial control, obviously, and they're a publicly traded business, so you have to step up the financial rigor, but they've never gotten involved. I haven't been involved in a while, so I can't speak to the present.
How long were you there post-acquisition?
I was there until the end of 13, I think.
So yeah, from when to when?
From, if we sold at the end of 11, I did the first 2 years of there now, right? And you were committed to 5 years. I then moved into other roles in WPP after the two-year mark.
How did your life change from pre to post-sale?
Different stress, different masters, it was probably a welcome change for all of us from the sort of scrappy days and all partner management. You know, it's sometimes good to have a boss, especially at a point in the business that it becomes, you can either have it become a lifestyle business of which you ebb and flow to make it work for however many shareholders there are, right? And that's a perfectly good business. I think we had stepped into a growth mode and expectation that wasn't really designed to be a lifestyle business. So you're suddenly hustling for the years that you now have to serve your new masters. I think different type of stresses, but also different types of opportunities. So on balance, I don't know that our lives changed that much.
Did you report to one person?
We actually reported to Mark Reed, who's now running the whole business, mm-hmm. who's the new WPP CEO. At the time, he was a WPP Digital, which was sort of a sub-operating,
Did he know what he was doing?
Totally. And does now. I mean, he's very, you know, it's a different interview for WPP, like get someone more informed. It's such an interesting evolution of legacy, creative meets global business and politics. Like the Sir Martin story is a fascinating one.
Was there earnout as part of it? So you had to hit certain targets, EBITDA targets or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. A mix of EBITDA and growth numbers and contribution to the.
So that was that 2 years of that? Or is that why you?
4 years.
It was 4 years. So you left before that was.
Yeah. 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 And, but I stayed within the group. So it was still all. It was all still kosher for the deal that was done.
Got it.
It presented, you know, professional opportunities for all of us, but both with clients and with other parts of the group that was either more global or more, you know, whatever you sort of wanted. And to think back to some of the Blue State staff, people popped up in lots of places. Like it was good for a lot of careers.
Well, it seems like from looking at your LinkedIn that you became the chief strategy officer for Burst and Marsteller, which is another notable company that they own.
Oh yeah, here in town,
what occasioned that change?
Big public affairs sort of legacy brand, right? They had just turned 60 years old as a business the year I joined or right around I joined. The CEO until recently was Don Baer, who's both a good friend and a lot of people in Washington know of. He's been from the Clinton administration through to Discovery when it was here in Maryland in the bubble, so to speak. I had known many of their both senior and sort of operations folks and shared some of the clients. And so it was a easy sort of transition of value to WPP. So basically the opportunities within the group are where can you take this talent and plug it into either client opportunities or operating company responsibilities.
So what does a chief strategy officer there
mix do? Of looking at acquisitions on behalf of WPP for the PR group, running what was a sort of small digital agency within Burson that serviced either clients on its own or more likely companion clients with other pieces of the business. And then a lot of global work on thinking how you, instead of just have the cost centers around the world, like Burson at the time had, I think, 86 global offices. And you imagine just that network built over time and you wonder where you can be doing interesting things for global clients like development in Eastern Europe or analytics. And, you know, what's the best use of the staff dollar to optimize that business?
Who went on to run Blue State?
Joe has. I mean, Yasha stayed for a while. Yeah. I don't remember exactly when Yasha left. So Joe remains, you know, long now past the earnout or long past the sort of commitment to WPP.
And how long were you at Burson?
Beginning of last year, basically, I sort of started leaving. Burson was merged into a different business within WPP. WPP's founder, I mentioned earlier, Martin Sorrell, had left in the spring, and it just felt like a good time. I was not obligated through the sort of golden handcuffs kind of thing, and just, had sort of made an exit over the course of the last, the first half of last year.
So what are you up to now?
Going from Blue State to Burson, the biggest life change or behavior change was when you're not immediately responsible for things, when you don't have, sure, you give up maybe the pride of ownership, but you reclaim a bit of what it is to have either work-life balance in conventional terms or just an identity outside of what you do.
Yeah.
I think many of us who've started businesses in DC and do the cause work or otherwise end up becoming so associated by the work we do and then have a life and friendships only sort of within the bubble of that work.
Yeah.
The person experience and then after has been a broadening of both my interests and sort of how I define my life.
Was that a hard transition for you? Like a lot of people I know, myself included, felt extremely identified with the company. And like there's a pride in that.
Yep.
And there's a connection to that. Was that hard to leave behind?
I don't think it was hard to leave behind. Nor would I say I left it behind in total, right? It's a realization of the piece it plays in your life. There certainly were moments that you're like, oh, was it the right decision to make? But I would honestly say very few of those, and typically only triggered like in therapy or something, and not really a longing feeling. And I do think you can quickly come to terms with that's a chapter of life. That's a significant chapter that gave a lot and provided a lot, and will probably be seen as a highlight chapter. But it is also a chapter.
Is it public? Or are you willing to share like what you sold Blue State Digital for?
No, that's no. Not.
But I'm assuming it was millions of dollars, and you guys all did well.
I think it could always go better, and it could always go worse.
Yeah. But it give you a certain freedom,
certainly.
Yeah,
certainly.
So you said you're up to a number of things right now,
right? I have been consulting on a few things. I've gotten involved in a business that was like Blue State Digital called Blue Labs, which is probably also on LinkedIn, which has political ties to Obama 12 and beyond, and a good guy
an analytics running a
data science
firm.
Exactly.
Why did you go try that a little bit?
Familiarity and fondness for the guys.
Do you like firms that start with blue?
Maybe. I mean, it was a little bit too much familiarity. I meant familiarity by way of I liked that they're a bootstrapped business as we were doing interesting things for interesting clients and at the right size that, you know, either with good client introductions or good sort of product ideas, it's just an interesting thing to get involved with.
The founding team there, compare them a little bit with the Blue State in strengths.
In strengths and weaknesses, it's hard in that there's so many to compare and they have different sort of Venn diagrams of pieces of certainly a similar split on, as I described, the from sales hustle to deep infrastructure tech building, like they represent that set of skills. You also add in a new dynamic, which we didn't even have from a deep analytics and the mindset of that and the application of that.
Which puts you in a slightly different, a fairly notably different niche.
Right. And I say we didn't have it at Blue State only like you would have if you started Blue State today, right? It was right. It's like what has evolved over the past, both in marketing science beyond, but certainly in politics. So I think you have that sort of mix of skill set. I think you also have a staff that is committed to the cause, but curious about the commercial. And they're on that.
So it sounds like
line.
A good fit for you.
I think it is a good fit. I mean, I think it's a DC-based business, and my life is in New York.
Yeah.
When I say I've gotten involved, it's like I am involved. I'm involved in some other things too. I've made an investment in a hospitality business. I'm advising on some boards. I'm doing some consulting works for nonprofits. I think enough to keep me engaged and not to define my life. I think I told you when we met a couple of weeks ago, I've wanted to be a parent for a long time. So that's both planning for that and overthinking that with my partner is becoming an item on the list that rises as time goes on.
Where does that stand, if you don't mind?
I think we're in exploration mode, talking to lawyers and talking to people that have both done the adoption and surrogacy.
Yeah.
One of the organizations I spend a lot of time with is the Family Equality Council, who have been for 40 years fighting for rights of gay and lesbian parents. And that 40 years represented a whole wide range of legal threats to parents.
And quite a sea change in
the country. And a huge sea change, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, among many in the movement, but the parenting thing is still a shocking, I think there's something like 19 states that don't allow same-sex parents on birth certificates. And even in New York State, where we live, it's only back on the governor's agenda now to change, to look at surrogacy laws because it's not legal in New York. Now you can go to Connecticut and you can go to Texas and you can go to whatever. But I say that as a wealthy white man, and that's a different journey
Becoming a parent, going through that is hard enough without having it be something that the government is in your business about in a negative way.
Right. It's a great little organization of the many in the LGBT movement. If you were a gay man 30 years ago and you were married and had kids, but then, you know, midlife came out, or, you know, say I was in my position, and you would often lose any rights to visit your children, you know, if the wife was so inclined to respond so harshly. So I do spend quite a bit of time on those issues and with those people.
When you introduced yourself, you said that you were from what we might now call Trump country.
Very much so.
Which I don't want to call it that, honestly.
Yeah, I know. You're right. But, good to correct me on that.
But that's not my purpose. What I'm wondering is, for someone who sat in a company in the middle of American politics,
yeah,
how do you view Trump now? And coming from a region that is more attuned to seeing him in a possibly positive way, how do you see him?
Wildly effective and scary.
You see him as effective.
I see him playing into the fears and vulnerabilities of the people I grew up with.
In a way that works.
In a way that works. And you wonder where is the line that it no longer works. I think it is a line. I think it is something that will turn one way or another. And he keeps pressing on that line.
Do you think he's ahead of them or they're ahead of him?
I know. I think they are right in line with each other, and the most powerful element of it, sadly, is still the race card and the dog whistles that are regularly rallying his base.
Do you go back to your part of Pennsylvania?
I do. We make sort of, you know, short trips. And I try to get my parents to visit us as much as possible. My sister lives in Pittsburgh, which is like the metro the media market that my hometown is in. And Pittsburgh's a cool little city that is great to visit and all of that.
And progressive.
And progressive, speaking, relatively, as a little enclave, right? Yeah. But when I last looked, I think my county is called Clarion. And it's about an hour and a bit northeast of Pittsburgh. And I think it was 76% Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And just to imagine that is...
The consensus is that he is the better choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll see the yard signs all over the place, I assume.
Yeah.
These are people I'm certain that you grew up, went to high school with. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you understand the attraction?
I guess I can. I guess I can innately because, like you say, I can associate with those people. My life was so different, and I, you know, credit or blame it to knowing I was gay pretty early. And so from, call it 12 or 13 on, sort of had this keen sense of I needed to get out of here.
Yeah.
Like that there was a world beyond.
You felt othered.
And that I was, I felt sort of othered, not in a brutal way, you know.
Did people know?
In retrospect, I think enough knew that I was bullied, but yeah, I think people knew. I don't think it was a great surprise that some years later, you know.
Well, how has that particular personal issue intersected your politics?
The lesson of the gay movement, again, with the tilt towards being a white gay man, which is harder. It's more normative now, and it's been like, if you're a white gay man, you're atop the world. Different, but the political lesson just was, as more people became aware of people coming out and realizing it's my grandson, it's my niece, it's the kid in school, that was the key to acceptance growing, you know, over that 10-year period that we went from. I moved to New York City in 95, peak AIDS death year. The AZT and others were introduced in, and so I think of my existence as a gay man and then my politics as a gay man sort of in that post-AIDS but still scared world. And the distance from that to marriage was so quick, especially when you realize that 2004 was decided by gay marriage, like opposing gay marriage in Ohio. Like, you know, George Bush won his reelection based on the last gasp
pressing
of an anti-gay
issue.
To me, I just think of it in the timing more than any political strategy per se, but just that's, again, my very myopic lens as a white man in that strategy.
You're married.
I'm not legally married, uh-huh. Only that it hasn't been sort of important to us. I have a partner now almost 4 years. We, you know, live and want to have the family together.
And you're thinking of a kid.
And we're thinking of a kid, and it'll probably benefit us to have legal.
You'll probably get married before.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah. So I could say I'm engaged, Gabriel, if you're listening.
I think that's why my wife and I got married.
Right.
Was to have kids. we probably ought to make
the legal protection that it affords to the kids as well as you as a co-parent, I think are probably meaningful.
So you've had this really interesting life in the intersection of politics and entrepreneurship. What lessons do you draw from that that would be useful to other people walking down that road?
The first is surrounding yourself with good people that you trust. And that doesn't always mean that you agree with, but you trust where they're coming from and the general judgment. And then I think there's a lot, especially in our worlds, there's a lot of businesses get founded through shared experience as opposed to the business logic of it, right? And so I think when I say surround myself, like make sure that you're building something with people that you know.
And it sounds like you're also saying implicitly, pay attention to the business logic as well as the shared principles.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think you're right that, well, that's often the difference between success and failure, right?
Right. And not to say, you know, one always outweighs the other. You can't take risks that may not have the strongest. But, you know, you've got to be nimble in it, but at least be working off of a clear scorecard. You know, you have to manage a business and a business partnership and an employee contract. There's a lot of businesses doing work that are really feel good that don't have a business logic to it. And I think you need to, that also for those that cross from vendor side into client side, find good clients. Like if you sense that a client is going to be really difficult and not be part of the continued success of the business, acknowledge that pretty early on because people can get seduced into short dollars from bad clients. You know, it could be a real weight.
Yeah, I had to jettison a number that were not a good fit and were painful.
Yeah.
And it cost, actually, I had to pay money to get rid of one, I remember, essentially.
Right.
And so that's
And those will happen, and not to beat yourself up over it, but I guess the lesson ongoing as they happen is to trust your instinct and act decisively.
Yeah.
You may be wrong, but at least you've bought insurance on the wrong, right? You know, you've acted in a timely way. I mentioned the talent side of businesses are always the hardest, particularly with a bent towards services and sort of clients. And talent can be really great talent that don't work out. And I think there's even a number of people from those many in my Blue State days and my Burson days that I've had many conversations about how in ways they thank me for making them realize it wasn't a good fit. Like it's almost like, thank you for firing me, but using nicer words. Like I think there's again, acting decisively when talent is in matter and respectfully, and you can have sort of shared friendships and ongoing, but it wasn't a good fit.
Is there a question that I should have asked that I failed to?
Wow. You didn't ask much about the current political game that we're in, which I think I appreciate because we all like to talk about it, but ultimately, who knows what's going to happen right now?
Yeah.
I can't decide whether I'm excited for the debate tonight or just want to hide and let them happen, and I'll read about it in the days after.
Yeah.
It just feels really powerless and on.
It's a pretty surreal time in the history of our country.
Yeah. And back to that Pennsylvania.
Dangerous.
Right. That the effectiveness of Donald Trump in my county in Pennsylvania. I remember when I used to write email copy, I would just think of my mother reading something. Not that that was my audience, but just thinking of the lens that's outside of the bubble we all live in and getting into the mindsets of people that will decide. I'm amazed that his numbers stay as strong as they do, or just that consistent base going in with
40%. Very likely.
Yeah.
Thomas, it's an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
Good pleasure. Good to have the chat.
Thanks very much. That was Thomas Gensimer of Blue State Digital and Burston Marsteller and Blue Labs. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.